The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly international break. Watford new manager WSL special. Harry Kane's hat-trick takes him above Sir Geoff Hurst in the goal-scoring chance as England see off Bulgaria. Wales keep it more interesting with a scratchy win, including a joyous own goal, while Scotland lose to Russia and Ireland leave it late to get a point at home. We'll round up the rest of the Euro qualifiers, including anthem problems in France and a point for Liechtenstein in Greece. Elsewhere, big attendances in Manchester and London as the WSL gets underway, and Watford have now sacked so many managers there's no one new to give the job to as Kike Sanchez Flores returns. We'll do all that, answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Susie Rack, hello.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
Yes, good to be back.
Mark Langdon, are you well?
I'm well, thank you, Max.
Excellent news. Jonathan Wilson.
Morning.
Now, obviously, Barry is washing his hair today, but he... Did you get through this on the pod that you hadn't washed your hair since 2002? Or is that just news that came out?
I've certainly tweeted it. I'm not sure if I've said it to anybody.
Okay. So you make Barry look like the Timotei woman.
Yeah. I was in Mali in 2002, ran out of product. Mm-hmm. And it turned out you don't need it. It's all a scam. And I think the anger that people have shown over this issue is a classic case of people who've made a terrible mistake in their lives and don't want to face it. But if you think of all that money you waste, mm-hmm, on shampoo, mm-hmm, on shower gel that you use on your hair, using on your body's fine.
Okay.
And then the product you have to put in to kind of to replenish the oils you're washing out.
Right.
Think of what, you know, if you invested that in even like a medium micer, like, you know.
It's always fascinating. I had no idea. I didn't realise this would, you know, prick the public consciousness as much as it has.
Well, I think what's telling is that I haven't used shampoo for 17 years. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew. It just proves.
Susie, did you know that Jonathan hadn't done that?
Nobody said.
Nobody said. Nobody knew.
No, you can't tell at all.
Exactly. I mean, admittedly, nobody around this table has been running their fingers through my hair in a... intimate manner.
No. Or a casual manner. No.
Any kind of manner.
England 4, Bulgaria 0. Jonathan, you were there at Wembley. What did you learn?
Well, I mean, it's easy to be sort of sniffy and say it doesn't really matter when it comes to winning a quarterfinal or a semifinal. Bulgaria were very, very average and very, very unambitious. So in a sense, it doesn't really matter. But on the other hand, there have been plenty of times in the past when England haven't swatted aside teams of that stature. They did. There's a sort of lightness to them, there's a fun to England, that even though, you know, once the first goal went in and probably before that, you know, there's a sense of it's a foregone conclusion. It's still fun watching Raheem Sterling and Marcus Rashford running at defenders and Harry Kane sort of scoring goals, and watching Harry Kane take a penalty is actually a great thing.
Mm. I've written here Harry Kane makes penalties beautiful, Susie, doesn't he?
He really does. Totally blossom. Made a nice change from the World Cup, the Women's World Cup, where England's penalties were less than desirable.
Yes, they were terrible, weren't they, generally? But the way he strikes a ball, Salah did it as well recently for Liverpool, Mark. There can be a beauty in penalty taking.
Yeah, and I think he's up to nearly 9 in 10 now in percentages of successful pens. It's sort of around the high 80s, which is, you know, way above average. And it actually...
And have you looked at... Have you got a split on kind of... I mean, my sense is recently he's been almost untouchable.
Yeah, I was going to say, in more recent... when he first broke through at Tottenham, he missed one in the Europa League. He also... I think the ground gave way at Southampton, maybe, and he missed that one against Liverpool, didn't he? A very vital penalty, and then scored about 2 minutes after at Anfield. But certainly recently, he's been absolutely phenomenal at them. And you cannot save those ones hit at power, you know, high into the corner, are just impossible for the goalkeepers to get to. There is obviously a risk involved in going for that part of the goal, because if you hit too high, you know it's you're going to hit the bar or it's going to go over. But he's probably the best around
well
at the moment.
He's scored 8 now for England, so only Frank Lampard has scored more.
I think Lewandowski, there's a lot of talk that Lewandowski is maybe slightly ahead of
Sounds like we all want the top 10 penalty records in the top 5 leagues since the start of 2017-2018. Would anybody like to have a guess to get one of the 10?
Lewandowski
in at 10,
16 penalties from 18, an 88.9%.
So, we're looking purely at percentage. Percentage. Is there a minimum requirement for how many penalties?
Minimum penalties, 10.
Okay.
So Lewandowski in 10, 88.9%.
Ronaldo?
Is not there. I mean, there's an easy one given who we've been discussing.
Harry Kane?
Harry Kane, sixth equal. 9 in 10, along with Ava Benega and Fabio Quagliarella.
Neymar?
Neymar is second. If anyone gets number one, I'll give you £100.
What league?
I don't know. He did play for Tottenham Hotspur. I believe Tim Sherwood gave him his debut.
Bentaleb.
Nabil Bentaleb, have £100. 12 from 12. Neymar's 10 from 10 with Cristiano Stuani. Sergio Ramos and Nicolas Pepe, 90.9, scored 10 from 11. And Milivojevic is in ninth place, 17 from 19. Artist Revolver says, I felt lately that penalties should count as half a goal towards a hat-trick. I'd like to have some expert opinions. I mean, I'm going to disagree, having discussed the beauty of penalties.
Yeah, I mean, Kane's second one was particularly beautiful, partly because he put the first one to the other side to where he normally goes. The second one was in classic Kane, and he smashed it into the boom mic so hard that when the ball bounced out, and I thought, as I hit the post.
The goal nets at the Dell.
Yeah,
that
well,
tight.
I wasn't absolutely certain it had gone in at first. Until, you obviously saw him running away celebrating and knew, but there was a sort of clunk as the ball hit the boom mic, and the boom mic swings away. So when I'm then looking at the goal, there's nothing there for it to have hit. So I was completely baffled. I saw it back on telly afterwards. The ball sort of bounced straight back towards him.
So look, that hat-trick takes him above Sir Geoff Hurst. One short of Brian Robson, 25 goals now. Rooney's record is 53. Would you rather, Susie, have Rooney's record of 53, Sir Geoff Hurst's record of 24, but a hat-trick in a World Cup final, or Harry Kane on 25 with the potential for greatness?
Hat-trick in a World Cup final every time, hasn't it? Like, that's guaranteed.
True. You are now sort of pushing 80.
And when we're talking about half goals, maybe goals that don't cross the line should only count for half.
That is possible, isn't it? Sterling and Rashford next to Kane. A lot of people thought Sancho might play for Rashford, but Rashford looks good in almost looks better in an England kit, doesn't he?
I felt in the second half he seemed to stay a bit wider. I don't know if maybe Southgate Jonathan, you would have I think if you're at the game you can sort of see these things easier, but it looked like maybe in the first half there was a bit of congestion through the middle, particularly down that Rashford side. But once he at Southgate, I think maybe had a word at half time, and he does look good out there. And I think that Sancho, although he's been brilliant for Borussia Dortmund, I quite like the idea of him coming off the bench against tight defences 20 minutes ago, maybe, in terms of knockout matches, extra time as well. I think him and Hudson-Odoi would be very good, to play in that role. I think that Rashford, given his performance for England, actually deserves it to keep his spot, even if maybe for Manchester United it's not going quite how he'd like, because he wants to play through the middle. But I think the opportunity is there sort of in a wider position.
Ross Barkley, it sort of seems to be the name on the team sheet currently, where everyone goes, oh, really? Do you think that's unfair?
I think...
So we wanted Maddison or Mount or someone new and exciting.
Yeah. I think it's not entirely fair in that he's played well for England recently. And given there is clearly with a whole load of players and in both directions, there's often a difference in club form and national form. If it's working for the national team, why would you change it? I know there was a lot of talk as well of whether it made sense to play Rice or whether you could have played Winks to have more of a passer there against a team who weren't going to cause you any problems, which I sort of see the logic of that. But at the same time, England won the game really comfortably anyway. And giving that three, if that is the first choice three, more time to practice together in a match situation, I think is not the worst idea. But I know what you mean, that Barkley sort of feels like he's a... The creativity three midfield has been an English problem for years, probably since Paul Gascoigne's problems, through the centre of midfield, to have somebody who's actually a, schema there on somebody making late runs into the box. So it's not really a surprise that's a player that we're sort of, is he really who we want? But it's great that we have the options of Madison and Mount.
Madison's the interesting one for me because Southgate has chucked in virtually all of the other young players really quickly. And Madison doesn't quite seem to have the same sort of trust maybe from the manager. I mean, Mount went on ahead of him against Bulgaria. There was a lot of call last year for Madison to be part of the national team, and it didn't come. There was talk of arrogance, wasn't there, in some of the under 21 players. Now, no names were mentioned in that from the failure of that summer, but I just found it quite surprising, given that Madison has probably been the best creative player, I think, in the Premier League this season in terms of English talent, and last season the chances he created at Leicester, that he hasn't been sort of given his opportunity yet. It's one to watch, really, is, you know, Southgate maybe prefers others.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, all that may well be true. I mean, I think there's a specific tactical thing that Madison at Leicester plays, you know, in a 4-3-3 or occasionally a sort of 4-1-4-1. Whereas Mount is playing in a 4-3-3, so maybe it's an easier sort of for somebody to step in.
Well, Southgate may bring him in. He may make changes for the game against Kosovo, which is at St Mary's tomorrow.
I mean, I'm sure he'll change the fullbacks over. I think that was the second choice pair played on Saturday.
Okay, because Kosovo is the trickier game.
Yeah,
arguably.
Which is an extraordinary thing to say, but it is true, I think.
They've not lost since October 2017. Came from behind to beat the Czech Republic on Saturday.
Yeah, 15 games unbeaten, which is the longest run in Europe.
Their World Cup qualifying campaign, 1-0, drawn 1, lost 9, 4-3 against 24. Their Euro 2020 qualifying campaign, 1-2, drawn 2, 4-7 against 5. Are we being naive to think we'll just turn these guys over?
Well, I would expect England to win pretty comfortably. I mean, most of those games that Kosovo have played they were in a very low Nations League group, so they were playing teams of a similar ability. And we've seen from Czech Republic and Bulgaria that this group, and Montenegro as well, this group is particularly weak and one of the easiest to get through. And England have scored 5, 5 and 4 in their three matches so far. So, I mean, Kosovo are doing brilliantly to be where they are, but I'd be surprised if England didn't win by a couple of goals and pretty comfortably as
well. I mean, it's obviously not always easy to tell from highlights, but the sense of that game beating the Czech Republic on Saturday was a little bit of a smash and grab. It wasn't like they were applying constant pressure to the Czech goal.
And that seems generous to put Danny Drinkwater in England news. He's been without a game for them since 2016. He's been ruled out for 6 weeks after getting beaten up outside a Manchester nightclub, leaving him with cuts and bruises to his face, a badly injured ankle. He has apologised for putting himself in that position. Sean Dyche has called him in for a meeting this morning to, quote, discuss his future. So the rest of the home nations. Wales beat Azerbaijan 2-1 at home. Mark, how much did you enjoy Pavlo Pashaev's own goal to give Wales the lead?
Yeah, I've watched it about 15, 20 times, I think, since it happened. I was trying to work out exactly how he did it. I thought at first it was that sort of 50 pence head where it had kind of gone off at a corner, but it looks like more sort of shoulder area.
Was it? I thought it was his... the point is, if you haven't seen it, Gareth Bale takes a shot which is blocked and it loops into the air. And then Pashaev, while the ball is in the air, decides that's the moment to just go for a casual jog. It's like he's not playing anymore. He's running away. He's not looking at the ball at all. I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? Maybe we take for granted footballers looking where the ball is
you often get criticised, don't you, for ball watching as a defender. So
that's what a hero. Well, he's trying to the ultimate non-ball watching. And the ball just hits him and everyone... It's one of those goals that you never see, so it's odd. And you can just see everyone on the pitch sort of genuinely surprised.
So I've not seen this. He's completely oblivious to...
Well, he's not oblivious. Once it hits him, he's pretty aware.
Yeah.
But before that, yeah, he just goes for it. He's sort of running to get into the position the ball might be going.
Amazing.
But he's decided not to look where the ball might go.
Goalkeeper also takes a bit of a wander as well and was at fault for the second goal.
True, but I think the goalkeeper's not expecting one of his players to run and let the ball hit him. I don't forgive him that.
Wales didn't look like they were going to score, though, and until that happened, did they? I mean, it was a really poor performance, I thought, from them.
Yeah, Ellis's point that he sort of feels, and I guess he speaks to a lot of Welsh fans, that he feels a very good generation of Welsh talent has been slightly wasted by a manager who's not really up to it.
I mean, there's still time. They're still young, aren't they? If you think of Lawrence and Wilson and James, especially, it's having them there while Bale and Ramsey are still playing.
Yeah, and
it's
having,
a really exciting
and having
line.
Them all fit. You know, you never know what might happen. Somebody might get injured. You know, and it does feel that a better manager get more out of them.
Yeah, I mean, they should sack Ryan Giggs. If the Watford owners were in charge, yeah, I mean, he'd be gone. I mean, you're always waiting for...
John Toshack would be back, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
But, you know, you're waiting for this bad result before you sack a manager. I think that Wales should act sort of now because they've got away with it. They shouldn't really have beaten Azerbaijan. It was a really poor performance, one that didn't look like a well-coached team. This is not the first time it's happened. It's been... virtually the whole way through the Giggs era. Bale got the winning goal but was playing in a very odd position for most of the game. I mean, when Chris Coleman got the best out of Gareth Bale, it was right through the middle, close to goal, and he was the main goal threat. And, you know, I know he got the winning goal, but a lot of that performance was done out wide, and it just looked like a very odd team performance from
him. Yeah, I mean, even the winner, I'm not suggesting it was a foul on the keeper, but...
Mm.
Some referees would give that.
Yeah.
I don't know who it is. He runs across the keeper's path, and I think the keeper sort of is distracted by that and starts to appeal, and then he's slow to react when Bale heads it back in.
But do you think in a way Giggs doesn't get a pass, but because people, and I presume the FA of Wales have a different view to me, but, you know, oh, it's plucky Wales, so anything they do is good. But actually, this set of players in international terms are good, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you can make a case this is a stronger squad than the one that got to the semis of the Euros. Ryan Giggs, to put in context what a bad manager he is, he led a Manchester United team to defeat at home to Sunderland. Nobody who's done that should ever be given an international job.
They play Belarus in Cardiff tonight in a friendly. Only 6,000 tickets sold in a 33,000 stadium. An opportunity missed to share international football with the rest of the country, says producer Jonathan. I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's good that England are taking their games... around, and it's what the Welsh should do too. Wales currently third behind Hungary and Croatia, who beat Slovakia 4-0. Dejan Lovren scored a goal for them. That's nice, isn't it? The Republic in Group D drew 1-1 with Switzerland at home. Important point. They're top of their group, 11 from 5. Denmark 2 points behind, Switzerland 3 behind with a game in hand. They needed a late header from David McGoldrick to salvage a point after Fabian Scher scored a lovely goal.
Really good goal, yeah.
Did he play in midfield for Switzerland or was he just going for a run?
No, I think he steps forward. I've never seen him play.
I mean, he has got a goal in him, hasn't he? He scored that brilliant goal last season where he belted it from miles from
Newcastle. That's
true. And he scored the goal that should have been ruled out for Hayden Handball last week.
This is the end of a sweeping move. And he started the move as well from centre-back. So that's what producer Jonathan says. So fair enough. He's roaming.
Just as important, I think, for Ireland was that Denmark result yesterday.
Sure.
It was a shocking game. I mean, I watched that to try and pretend the Ashes wasn't happening. And, I mean, it was just an awful afternoon.
A goalless draw with Georgia.
Yeah, a terrible game of football.
Was it more attritional or less attritional than Jack Leach and Craig Overton desperately trying to fend off the Aussies for hours?
Well, there was very little sense of sort of moral valour about it. And the other strange thing, I don't know what was going on, but there's American football markings on the pitch in the Paishadza in Tbilisi, which seems odd. I don't know if do they play American football in Georgia?
Well, either that or it's a curious decision of the groundsman.
Play a lot of rugby, don't they? Could it have been rugby?
No, definitely had the numbers.
Other fun thing from that game, James McLean smacked the bar. And it was a great moment when Breel Embolo was through and was about to score and then just fell over. Like one of those toys. And kids, this is not a reference for anyone under probably 38. You know those toys where they were sort of had, they were like a wooden toy and they had a little button at the bottom and they were made with taut string. And when you pushed the button, they would sort of collapse.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're still around.
Are they still
My
around?
My son's got some of those.
Oh, really? Oh, that's great. So everyone can join in with that analogy. That tortuous analogy is for all the listeners. Yeah, he just fell over. Republic hosts Bulgaria tomorrow night in a friendly. Switzerland beat Gibraltar 4-0. How do we see Mick McCarthy's tenure so far?
It's exactly how I expected it to be, really. It feels like they're all pulling in the same direction, which I don't think was the case under the, you know, towards the end of that Martin O'Neill, Roy Keane era. But you can only work with what you've got, really. And I think Ireland football will be attritional, and it's the only way they're going to qualify. They are putting quite a lot of effort into the under-21s and trying to build through this next generation. And, you know, Troy Parrott is one that they're very excited about. But, you know, with the players they've got, I think this is basically all that the Ireland can do.
Be yeah, nice. I can't work out if the sort of the plan they've got in place and McCarthy to, you know, run it through till after the Euros and then Stephen Kenny comes in. I can't work out. I mean, I assume it's a bad idea because it's John Delaney's idea, and I presume there's something dodgy about it. But it, I mean, you've also, you have got the, it's a ridiculous point, but what if they win the Euros? Does McCarthy still get the push? Or, like, you know, even if they kind of, I don't know, get to a plucky quarter final, you know, are they still happy for him to stand aside?
I would quite like Ireland. I'd like one international country to try and have a DNA that was attritional, to say this is what we're doing.
Oh, well, definitely do that.
We're making our under-14s, under-15s, under-20s all play attritional park-the-bus football. That is the DNA that we are spreading for every single Irish footballer for a generation.
Is that not Norway? It certainly could feel be, yeah. Like it was Norway for a while.
But I heard Damien Delaney talking about this last week and going about, after the game, because, you know, Ireland disqualification campaign of, have they scored one in every game apart from the two they got against Gibraltar? Is that correct? Yeah. So, they've had 2-1-0 wins, 2-1-1 draws, and a 2-0 win. And Damien Delaney go, oh, yeah, we've got no identity. We need to build an identity. You don't mean that. What you mean is we want to completely change the very clearly defined identity we have and start playing passing football.
Well, it would have changed their whole attitude to the Grealish thing. They'd have said, look, he's not part of our plans. Yeah. He's a diminutive ball-playing midfielder. That's not what we need here. That's not our DNA. They were rugby markings, by the way, not American football
markings.
Well,
they had numbers, though.
In Tbilisi.
There's definitely numbers there.
Listen, I'm merely the conduit between a conversation between you and producer Jonathan writing things down. I suggest you two have it out after the pod is over.
They do definitely play rugby there. That's definitely true.
Okay. Well, I'm fascinated. Right, that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Scotland's defeat to Russia. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Live shows, Leeds on the 20th September, sold out. Me, Barry, you, Jonathan, and Faye Carruthers. Whereas tomorrow, still some tickets available for Manchester. Me, Barry, Wilson, and Lars.
Who'd have thought England v Kosovo was such a draw that people would rather watch that than come and...
If it means anything, what we could always do is put it on a little iPad just at the front of the...
What time are we kicking a week? We're starting at 6:30.
We're starting at 6:30.
I'll be done by the time.
Exactly. We'll be done for kickoff or just after. And we know it'll be 0-0 after 25 minutes.
Always is.
Exactly.
Always is.
Few tickets remaining for that. Buy them and come along. And you can hug Barry and ruffle his hair afterwards if you want to. And Wilson, we could do that. Almost certainly, I'd say 50% of the show will be hair-based discussion. Scotland in Group I lost 2-1 at home to Russia. John McGinn put them ahead. They let in two. Artem Dzyuba and a Stephen O'Donnell own goal. Not a lot he could have done about it. It means they're below Kazakhstan and miles behind Belgium and Russia. They're just waiting for the Nations League now, aren't they?
For the playoff, you mean? Yeah. I do like Dzyuba. He's a very kind of... very British type of centre forward,
classic old big dirty number nine type.
Yeah. And you know he's been quite stroppy in the past and fallen out with various managers and things. And he's a good thing.
Okay, well I'm pleased. Who else? Which other old foreign strikers do you like? Bash Dost. You could take him or leave him. Is that a cliche?
Yeah,
I like him.
He's just got a funny name, hasn't he? That's the only
and he's what, 8 foot tall.
I like Cenk Toshin, actually. I know he hasn't done it for Everton, but I really liked him at Besiktas.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Well, you asked the question.
I did. Yeah, you're right. It's my own fault. I should stop doing
it. I thought it was a dull question.
I should stop doing that,
shouldn't I? Spent a good 30 seconds coming up with an answer, and then you sneer. What do you want me to say? Ollie McBurney.
Well, on Ollie McBurney, thanks for that. After he said
that's that, professionalism, that is giving you a segue.
Yeah, you know, I appreciate that.
There's a ladder.
Anyway, what did he say? He said it was shit going to watch Scotland. He's apologised. He said it was a private conversation in the dressing room. 5 seconds were taken out of context. No one heard the rest of the conversation. Nonetheless, it looked terrible. It was stupid from me. I guess there is a point, though, Susie, isn't it, that footballers spend a lot of time training. And it is important for them that it is fun and interesting and dynamic. And I wonder if as fans we don't appreciate that they are doing that a lot, and it's key for it to be fun and engaging.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to lose, you at least want to have some sort of pleasure from it. When fans are paying money to watch it, you want to be engaging in some way, don't you? Either that through the way you play or just making it look like you're enjoying it. I enjoy watching football when players are enjoying playing football. If you can tell they're kind of disinterested, you don't want to watch, do you?
I think they talk a lot about training. So, you know, when you say, oh, what's it like out there? They go, oh, the sessions are great. When they talk about coaches that we don't really pay any attention to,
this happens a lot, though, doesn't it? International football, when the team's not successful, you get. I mean, Scotland have had plenty of withdrawals in recent years, and I mean, there was always talk about, you know, England wasn't a great place to be, but you can just go right through any team that sort of has these bad results. There tends to be more withdrawals from the squad.
Yeah, but I mean, I wonder which comes first. Do they have bad results because people don't want to play for them, or do people not want to go there because they have bad results?
And also, there's that whole kind of, how could you not want to represent your country? I would climb over the trenches for England. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't. I'd go and hide, you know.
Sound a little bit like Phil Neville last week.
What did he say exactly?
He said that he wakes up in the morning, and if he's having a bad day, he looks down at his shirt and sees the three lions and realizes that he can never have a bad day.
Does he always wear kit?
Clearly in bed, you know, like literally as he wakes up, he looks down, sees the three lions. Oh, he's got a tattoo. I don't know. Yeah,
that's
maybe.
True. Maybe he's just more of a patriot.
Bleeds England.
That's true. I would obviously like to play, but if you're a footballer, it's a bit different because you're doing it all the time. It's not magic if that's your job.
Yeah, and I can see how you could very quickly become disillusioned. You know, if you're playing for a country where things aren't set up very well, you know, if you're used to kind of Champions League facilities and everything, and you go and play for a country where not means you don't have the facilities, but everything's a bit disorganised, you suspect the coach is on the take to pick certain players, your teammates aren't really trying that hard, I can see why you would become pretty disillusioned. I mean, I remember, it's on this question of why the training being fun matters. I remember before year 2008 talking to a load of Russian players who was suddenly kind of massively enthused by playing for Gus Hiddink, because they're saying, you know, previously Russian training was you got there and you ran your laps and you did your sprints, and then on the Thursday somebody might show you a ball eventually, and there was like, this is ridiculous, why are we doing fitness work in the middle of the season? Was Gus Hiddink's just, you know, there's a ball, let's have a laugh, kick it about, we'll do some tactical work now for 10 minutes, right, kick a ball about again. And yeah, suddenly everybody was desperately wanting to be part of the Russia setup.
Can it make you a worse player if you're like not enjoying your time at the national team, do you think? So that's one of the things that Ada Hegerberg said when she stopped playing for Norway, is that she was coming back from camps a worse player than she was going in.
Yeah, I mean, that is pretty impressive for a coaching session, isn't it? But you only got them for a few days.
But McBurney, the word he used to describe the Scotland setup, described that performance against Russia pretty well. I mean, the midfield is supposed to be good for Scotland. You look at it on paper with McGregor, McGinn, and also McTominay. That should be a good platform for the nation of Scotland size to build on, and to, I think, beat Russia at home. I think that they should expect to win that game, or at least be more competitive. Russia had more shots on target, more possession, created all of the sort of good opportunities in that game. It was a yet another really disappointing performance, and it looks like the Hampden Park crowd have kind of given up on the team as well.
It's a funny old stadium that these days as well. It kind of feels so kind of depressing. It's like the worst of all possible worlds. It's sort of got the shape of an old stadium, but has this sort of plasticness of a new stadium.
They host Belgium tonight, who won 4-0 in San Marino on Friday. Two for Batshuayi, Mertens and Chadli with the goal. Steve Clark says, maybe it's a good fixture for us because I don't think there's any expectation. I don't think he needs to think, does he? But you never know. Group C, Northern Ireland. They beat Luxembourg 1-0 in a friendly. They won 4 from 4. Their games get a bit trickier now. They host Germany tonight. Michael O'Neill's been speaking about how much of the squad has changed. You know, Chris Brunt, Chris Baird, Gareth McCauley, those guys have all gone. Young players like Jamal Lewis and Bailey Peacock-Farrell and Gavin White expected to play a bigger role. Germany, of course, lost to the Netherlands in quite a fun game, Mark. Had one of those ridiculous handballs, which brushed De Ligt's hand when he was looking the other direction. And then Netherlands scored 2 on the counter. But this will be a very tough game for Northern Ireland.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as far as Northern Ireland go, that was the worst result for them, really. Holland picking up maximum points away to Germany because they've split that kind of double header now. And so, you know, to try to get up, I think they wanted Germany to win and then hope that they could maybe put pressure on the Dutch. I mean, Germany at 1-0 had a good opportunity through Royce to go 2-0 up. And I think if that goes in, maybe they go on to win the game. But the second half performance from Germany was as laughably bad as sort of the Nations League and the World Cup. They're defending on the halfway line with no pressure on the ball. And it's quite easy, just chip it over the top. And, you know, Memphis was running onto it. Wijnaldum dominated them in midfield. There's a lot still for Germany to work on. That back three of Ginter, Tarr and Suala just doesn't look good enough. And yet he's refusing to bring back Hummels, who I think, if you're looking at it pound for pound, is probably still their best defender.
He probably is, but if you're going to defend on the halfway line, you can't play Hummels because he's so slow on the turn. So
do you think they'd benefit from having a more experienced international manager?
Well, definitely better from having a good manager rather than somebody who's lucked out and the luckiest World Cup winning manager in history.
But has he become a bad manager, Love, or has he always been bad?
He's not obviously
or is he?
He's obviously not bad,
right?
But I've always, you know, I think the best Germany under his management was the one in 2010. We played on the break, lost in the semi to, you know, really, really good Spain side, which is, you know, it happens. But you know, they had a very clear plan. It kind of worked for, you know, extremely well. And since then, it's almost like he hated that designation of them as a counter-attacking side and keeps on trying to be more proactive and never gets the balance right. And in 2014, they were a shambles in the group. You know, if Jordan Ayew had a brain, they might have gone out in the group stage. I mean, thankfully, that's a long way from being the case. And they end up going back to the very sort of cautious counter-attacking style from the quarterfinal onwards, and it works. So I don't know why he hasn't just stuck to that. You know, it's what they're really good at. And he's really mismanaged the rejuvenation of the squad. So, you know, he took that B team to the Confederations Cup and they won it. And then he barely picked any of those players the following summer.
They've got a good pool of players.
And then when it comes to begin to replace players, he does it in this incredibly brutal way. Like, you know, Müller and Hummels are never going to play for me again. You don't have to do that. You can sort of very slowly integrate the new players in. Plus, you've had all the Özil stuff happening in the background, which I think has been dealt with incredibly unsatisfactorily.
Germany have won every meeting with Northern Ireland since 1997. There were 3 draws in the mid-90s. The last time Northern Ireland won this fixture was 1983. Oh, who scored in that game?
Norman Whiteside.
Correct. Was it 1-0? Yeah, well done, Jonathan Wilson. That was a great quiz because I didn't know the answer.
they played each other at the 1958 World Cup.
In which World Cup?
58.
Ah, yes, that was the one I was thinking of. how did they get on?
I presume West Germany won. The group was Czechoslovakia, West Germany, Argentina and Northern Ireland.
Okay.
And it's when Argentina got beat 6-1 off the Czechs, precipitating their descent into anti-football.
Northern Ireland won 1-0 in both of their qualifying matches against Germany in Euro 84. Does Jonathan Wilson, anyone else can join in too, know the score in the other game? Pat Jennings?
I wasn't born.
Norman Whiteside.
Also Whiteside. You weren't born,
no,
Susie.
Yet.
You're allowed to know things before you were born.
Pre-birth, really.
You are, yeah. This is a good question.
Jerry Armstrong.
Jerry Armstrong is the other obvious guess. Sammy McElroy.
Donaghy. There's a guy who played for Newcastle, Dave McCreary. Was it?
Yeah. David McCreary, yeah.
Yeah, who's had like a massive head. He looked like a sort of 50-year-old postman. Ian Stewart.
Ian Stewart. It's been a long time before I got to that.
Great quiz, everyone. Group F. Spain have won 6 from 6. They only just got past Romania. They went 2 up before Florian Andone scored a header. Then Llorente was sent off for a good tackle, I thought. And there was no VAR in these qualifiers. Do we know why? Is it because they've been so busy overturning decisions in the Premier League?
They said it wasn't possible in all grounds. They haven't. You can't have it for some and not others. So.
Romania missed a really good chance. Andone had a good easy header that Kepa saved, and it rebounded out on their left back. Booted it over the bar. But Spain followed that with a 4-0 win over the Faroes last night.
It went very good against the Faroes.
Were they not?
Yeah. For some reason on my telly, the match choice thing doesn't work, so I was forced to watch that.
What were you trying to get to?
I wanted to watch Italy-Finland.
Oh, yeah, that was a more interesting game. Or is it just because Wright isn't working on your remote?
There's a problem with the first two Sky channels and some of the film channels, and also Premier. And get Premier up at my mum's house, but not in London for some reason.
Oh.
It just and you're trying to get to the you press the red button to get the choice. That doesn't work.
Producer Jonathan's written, "Good God Almighty!"
That's the fucking question. You don't want that fucking answer.
Sweden and Norway shared the Norse spoils with a 1-1 draw.
I'm in a WhatsApp group with Lars, and he
just the two of you. That's a conversation, really.
Yeah, to talk about Norwegian football. He was saying that Norway picked 4 central midfielders.
Oh, good.
For that game. Which I mean, it's still a good point, I suppose.
Who else is in that WhatsApp group?
Andy Brassel.
Oh, wow, this is a who's who of European football experts.
Kevin Hatchard, the German Bundesliga commentator.
This is extraordinary. How nerdy does this get?
Very.
Basically, it's between Norway, Sweden and Romania for second spot, probably, with Spain walking away with it. Group H, France 4, Albania 1. Anthem gate was great. France accidentally played the Andorran national anthem. The Albanians were very unhappy. The stadium announcer then apologised to Armenia. The Albanians were still unhappy. The Albanians refused to play until their anthem was played. And then they played and got hammered. Also in that group, Iceland 3, Moldova 0. Turkey needed a last-minute winner to sneak past Andorra. France, Turkey and Iceland all joint top of that group. In group B, Portugal won 4-2 in Serbia. Mitrovic scored a banger for Serbia. Ronaldo scored a nice little dink. Bernardo Silva made the point safe 5 minutes from time. Mark, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, it's just that Portugal have got, on paper, quite an exciting team, I think, coming up over the next 12 months if Fernando Santos plays them all, because João Felix didn't start that game. But if you get João Felix, Cristiano Ronaldo, Bruno Fernandes and Bernardo Silva in the same team, I mean, they're not really in the conversation about sort of retaining their European Championship at the moment, but that sort of title. But I looked, the potential of that front four would be, best in the tournament, or certainly right up there.
They're not in the conversation for winning the European Championships. Are they in the WhatsApp conversation?
I'm trying to keep that one to myself to make a few quid out of them next summer. So.
Okay. Also in that group, one for City's Oleksandr Zinchenko as Ukraine beat Lithuania. They're 8 points clear.
They're playing
at the
really top. Well, the Ukraine at the moment. They're 9 points clear of Luxembourg in third. So, I mean, pretty much nailed on. I mean, they've played a game more, but pretty much nailed on to qualify.
Group J, Italy 1-2-1 in Finland. Timu Pukki had equalised from the spot for the Finns in the 72nd minute. Scottish ref Bobby Madden then gave Italy a penalty for a handball where Nicolò Barella's shot was handled by the Finnish centre-back. But it's so...
The handball law is broken.
Because he smacks it and it's point-blank range. His hand isn't away from his body, but it is going in. So that seems less harsh than the De Ligt one for me.
Yeah, but neither of them
should
have.
They're both a nonsense. Jorginho scored the penalty. But they didn't have an easy international break, Mark, did they, really?
No, but people are getting quite excited about the sort of the emergence of this Italian midfield. I mean, they did still win 2 tricky-ish, I suppose.
I mean, the red card that Armenia got just before half-time was a joke as well.
Yeah.
Talk us through it.
2 yellows for what the first one was for was.
I only saw the second one. So
the second one, he sort of jumps for a header with Bonucci, and his arm catches Bonucci. But
I forgot the game was on, and for sort of first 25-30 minutes. But I mean, you look at that Italian midfield with Jorginho, Barella, Sensi's coming through. You got Verratti as well. That's pretty decent.
Are you putting them in the conversation?
I'm putting them in the conversation.
Wow.
I mean, they're probably below the kind of obvious candidates, I think Mancini, it may take sort of the next tournament for them to really show their true worth.
Yeah, but this year is going to be really... I mean, I worked out my schedule for next summer. I worked out where I'm going to be staying. But because there's however many hosts, 12 hosts, like, there's a lot of teams who are going to have very easy passages through their groups. Because they're all, you know, they're automatically seeded. They play guaranteed two games at home. So whereas, I don't know, like... Italy v Ukraine in Munich might be quite a testing fixture for Italy. Italy v Ukraine in Rome, it'll be quite easy for them. And so I think, you know, that's going to massively skew.
Does anybody like the fact it's being played across Europe?
Well, I don't. Not now that I've booked my hotels and everything, booked my Airbnbs. Mainly because I don't like watching the hosts. Watching hosts, you get all of the too many fans get excited by it. You get all this terrible jingoism. And so, you know, I tend at tournaments to try and avoid watching the hosts. But you can't avoid them here. So I'm going to Budapest because I'm hoping Hungary don't qualify. Nothing against Hungary. I just kind of would like to have a quiet time in Budapest watching nice football. But
is it a sensible idea? I mean,
what I was about to say there was the objection to it that it doesn't feel like...
All the other ones previously have, yeah.
I don't really buy because... Getting about at this tournament, so getting from London to Glasgow to Dublin, or, you know, from Amsterdam to Copenhagen, or from Budapest to Munich, all these things are much, much easier than getting about Poland, Ukraine, for instance, or getting about Brazil at the World Cup. So in that sense, I think that's a flawed argument, that the idea of the World Cup as a sort of community, or the European Championship as a tournament as a community, It's existed very rarely.
Sure, recently. But in terms of sort of, you know, the idea of tournaments that you look back and you go, you know, whatever it was, a Euros or a World Cup, and you think, Mexico 86, that's where it was, you know, and maybe that's a nonsense argument as well. I don't know.
No, but I think that's in terms of experience of being there, which is obviously different from how it's marketed and branded. But the experience of being there in the days when a group would be in two cities and the teams would base themselves in one of those two cities or somewhere in between, and you've got a much more community feel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's a really positive thing, a really good thing. And I understand they don't do it because they don't want sort of fans to sort of think this is our territory and then start defending that territory. They want fans moving about to prevent sort of tribal gatherings of fans. But, you know, you all those stories you get from, you know, from say from 66, for North Koreans sort of big embrace by the people in Middlesbrough. Or I interviewed Josef Szabo when he was Dynamo Kiev manager, and at the end of this hour-long interview he sort of said, where are you from? I said Sunderland. I hadn't realised he played for the Soviets for the 66 World Cup, being based in Sunderland Polytechnic, and he just goes on and on about Sunderland. But even I was bored of him talking about how nice Sunderland was, and that is now sort of lost.
And also like, for fans who go, it's about, you know, cities that you don't necessarily go to, you know, or you learn about, whether it was, you know, in Russia or, Women's World Cup in France, you might not know of. I mean, people know about Lyon, right? But you don't automatically go, I'm only going to Paris. You go, okay, and I'm only going to Rome. And actually, you know, in Mexico 86, you hear of these places like Monterrey or Guadalajara or whatever. You're like, I don't know anything about these things.
I don't know, if I could give Le Havre a skip, I would.
Anyway.
Don't tell Philippe, his hometown. What I would say about Le Havre was during that tournament, the big Niemeyer Library had my book displayed in the entrance hall. Therefore, I think Le Havre is an excellent city.
Blimey, they only have one book.
I think they might have had a range of football books. But
okay. Look, well done to Liechtenstein. They drew 1-1. In Greece, after a run of 19 consecutive defeats in competitive matches, their entire population could fit inside the Olympic Stadium in Athens. 20,000 empty seats. You could have got 18-1 on the draw there. That's nice, isn't it?
Greece have had some absolutely shocking results in the last 5 or 6 years.
Whatever emotional mortgage they took out to win Euro 2004, they're really paying it back now.
So well done to Liechtenstein. In Group G, Poland's 100% record is gone after losing to Slovenia. They're still on the top.
That was a beautiful pass for the second goal. I can't remember who played it, sorry. But a lovely ball, the outside of his left foot into the striker's path.
That's nice. WSL time. Susie, you had a busy weekend. You were at Stamford Bridge yesterday for Chelsea 1, Spurs 0. The Etihad the day before for City 1, United 0. Firstly, big attendances. And I know there were reduced prices and freebie giveaways and stuff, but That seems to me like a real positive.
Yeah, I mean, there was, over the weekend, if you include the other games as well, there's combined attendances of about 62-ish thousand people watching. And over the 110 games across the whole of last season, there were about 92,000 attending. So, like, it's a big, big change. Both were actually really good atmospheres, Stamford Bridge in particular, though a smaller number. I think partly because the stadium is a bit better for an atmosphere. Was really buzzing, and they put a lot of work into kind of really making it a decent atmosphere. There's a big argument about, you know, kind of whether paid for tickets or free tickets are the better way to go, and whether you're undervaluing women's football if you don't put a price on it. But for me, the bigger question was over announcing a sold out game versus kind of slowly building towards a bigger crowd. Because in the build up to the City game, the Manchester Derby, they didn't really tell us what ticket sales were. We got a couple of days before, we kind of got sort of a over 20,000 number, and then the day before it was all rumours of 25,000-26,000, and then on the day itself, you know, when in the press box you're hearing, oh, possibly 30,000. So then when the over 31,000, nearly 32,000 was announced, it felt good. You felt like, yes, we've really climbed, this is great. Whereas Stamford Bridge, because they sold out, in inverted commas, the free tickets within 4 days over a month ago, they didn't have any kind of like build up, any kind of momentum to gather before it. So, and then obviously, if you're saying you've sold out 42,000 tickets, anything less than that is automatically seen as a disappointment. So I get that they looked at a lot of the stats that say that if you give away free tickets, you're going to get at least a 50% turnout. So, you know, you give away 40,000 tickets, you're guaranteed 20,000 people minimum. And they got more than that. But coming out of the stadium, when you've talked about a sellout for over a month with 25,000 people there, it's not kind of the same degree of
excitement, but it's still, still a lot of people watching the women's game, right? And,
exactly.
And Emma Hayes after that game said, look, it was good that it was only 1-0 because she didn't want like to win 7-0, which sort of sounds counterintuitive, because she wanted it to be tight and wants then to get those fans to go to Kings Meadow, right? That's the key. Was it a good game, that one?
It was. It was really tight. And Tottenham put in a real shift. I feared them getting hammered, and I fear them getting beaten heavily when they host Arsenal at the Tottenham Stadium in front of their home fans. You know, the last time I saw Arsenal play Spurs competitively in women's football was about 2-3 years ago in the FA Cup, and they lost 10-0 in pre-season with a Arsenal side that was kind of very, very depleted. They lost 6-0. So I think it was really, really good that every single game across the whole of the league only had a 1-goal margin.
And it was a great goal from Beth England, wasn't it? Left foot,
it was
top corner. Fred
stunner.
Says, did the panel enjoy how well Chelsea women mirrored the men in starting like a hurricane, only to lose their way, almost let lesser opposition get something? Is this also down to the limitations of Frank Lampard, the midfield general?
I'd be surprised. I mean, I doubt he's taking training.
The other great goal, City's Caroline Weir, absolutely wonderful goal. I thought, naively perhaps, that City would sweep aside United, and they didn't. It was close.
Yeah, see, United have got a really good team, because I mean, they spent the whole of last season building towards being in the WSL. It was what it was about. It was getting them ready. And they've made some really decent signings. Jackie Gronin, the Dutch midfielder, is phenomenally good. And they've brought in, I think, 5 or 6 Women's Super League experienced players into the team. And they've got some really exciting players. Lauren James came on only for about 10 minutes at the end, but she's 17 and is probably the most naturally gifted player I've seen since Kelly Smith.
Wow.
And she, I mean, she had a fantastic run into the box and sort of kind of stumbled over the ball, but that was her first introduction to Women's Super League football. I think it's going to be really exciting to watch her. And City also had the kind of hindrance of most of their squad being away on an international break last week, and only having kind of 2 days to turn around between coming back from that, including, I think they had six England players in their starting lineup. So, I mean, yeah, it was kind of a bit of fortune on United's part that City had that kind of slight setback of not much prep time, but also they are a decent side. And looking at the league, I could see them getting up to fourth in their first season, potentially.
What did you make of Casey Stoney, the United manager, not attending the press conference? And this obviously got journalists very exercised, because it is their right to sit in a press conference. I mean, press conferences seem the most tedious things in the world anyway, but you've probably got to turn up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was she did the mix zone, but she did the mix zone to two people because none of us knew she was doing that. Now, there was some kind of miscommunication, apparently. Some people were told at halftime in the press room that she was only doing the mix zone, but you had 30-ish journalists sitting literally next door to the mix zone waiting for her, being told that she was coming. So obviously frustrations were high. And then we were told that she didn't want to come because she had done the mix zone. So apparently that's not true. Apparently she had no idea that we were there waiting for her.
More like a surprise party. It's so close that all these people want to see you and you don't see it.
It just seemed a little strange that you wouldn't notice the absence of the entire women's football press, to be honest. But yeah.
But also, they didn't get hammered. I mean, you sort of think, why wouldn't you turn up? You played all right.
I mean, plus, I personally wanted to use Casey top line, really, because for me, she usually gives us a little bit more than Nick Cushing does post-match, not in a negative way. They played really well. The first half, for 70 minutes of the game, I thought they were the better team. So it was frustrating not to be able to talk to her.
Champions Arsenal won. Good to see Jordan Nobbs back on the pitch.
Very emotional for me as an Arsenal fan. It's really good to have her back. She's now missed two World Cups through injury and missed most of last season to injury, but still finished third in the top scoring charts. So she's just so important to Arsenal's midfield and just such an exciting player to watch.
How much better would we have done in the World Cup? I mean, maybe it's a silly question, you can't answer it, but she was a real hole, wasn't she?
When she got injured, I thought, that's it, we're not winning the World Cup. That's literally how important I thought she was. Like, before that, I thought we got a serious chance. Jordan got injured and I thought, that's it, chance gone. There's no way we're winning the competition. She's that good. She's so important to midfield. We haven't really got another player like her who kind of has that drive and creativity in the middle. Jill Scott is probably the closest, but the pair of them together, I think we would have been flying.
And what do you make of the FA player? You can see full match highlights if you want to, and little highlights as well. It seems to be reasonably well put together.
Yeah, it's really good. I was really, really surprised when I opened it for the first time at how kind of slick its usability is. And the thing that that I hadn't actually thought about was when we sat down, I can't even remember, time sort of blurred into one because it was such a hell 2 days where we sat down with 24 players, two from each club, half an hour each, literally back to back for 2 days. A lot of the players, the international players, were singing the praises of the FA player because their families and friends have never been able to watch them play in England, and that was a massive deal for them.
So in the EFL, there's a big debate at the moment though over iFollow and whether it's actually better to have the fans through the gate watching the game rather than maybe just sitting at home on the computer. Is there a fear maybe that, you know, attendances could be damaged by the fact you can, you know, just watch it at home?
I think that's the reason why they haven't necessarily done it before now, but I think now there's a feeling that you won't necessarily conflict much, the crossover won't be that. It's like with a fan zone at a major tournament, you know, will the fan zone draw fans away from going to the game? I think it's a different kind of fan, isn't it? And particularly in terms of building the profile of the league as one of, if not the best in the world internationally, and also being able to sell rights internationally, you know, sold rights to the league to Mexico and places like that. It's opened a lot of doors.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll begin with some breaking managerial news. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Jolyon tweets, was Football Weekly recorded before Danny Cowley was announced as the new Huddersfield manager? No, Jolyon, because the breaking news is that Danny Cowley has agreed to be the Huddersfield manager. The move looked to be off last week. Does that mean, Mark, you watched his final ever game as Lincoln boss?
I did watch his final game as Lincoln boss, and also that these rumours started on Friday night. His odds collapsed from around about 14-1 to, you know, 1-5 on. And Lincoln played on Saturday like there was something amiss, particularly in the first half. They were nothing like the Lincoln that Danny Cowley has brought up from the National League, that had, you know, won promotion from League Two, that reached an FA Cup quarter-final, that won the EFL trophy. Him and his brother Nicky have done an unbelievable job there, just like they did at Braintree and Concord. And, you know, they were always, I think, destined to move up. A little bit surprised they've done it mid-season, because, you know, they were building something at Lincoln, and he persuaded a lot of players to go there over the summer. And I think that they'd all bought into what the Cowleys were about. But maybe they felt like a championship job for a team that just dropped out of the Premier League was one that they, you know, couldn't refuse. I think he's a great man manager. I also feel that, you know, tactically his brother Nicky does a lot of that side of things. I think it's a really good appointment. The interesting thing is, though, that Huddersfield's fans used to joke that Jan Sievert looked like a PE teacher on the sidelines and was so out of his depth. And of course, Danny Cowley actually was a PE teacher until not that long ago, but I think it's a good appointment. You can never tell. I thought that Nathan Jones would do a great job at Stoke, and he hasn't, but I can understand why they've gone for somebody like the Cowleys.
He replaces Jan Sievert, who left in mid-August after one win in 19. Meanwhile, Huddersfield have been fined $50,000 for their Paddy Power kit sponsorship stunt in pre-season friendly against Rochdale. They were warned on the day of the match by the FA they would face action if they wore the shirt. They decided to use a training kit instead. But when Paddy Power were informed, according to Huddersfield chairman Phil Hodgkinson, we were threatened with legal action. The sponsor said it would be deemed to be a material breach of the sponsorship agreement if the team did not wear the oversized logo. So they went ahead with it.
I mean, whichever Huddersfield lawyer drew up the contract that meant they were legally obliged to break FA regulations, that's a pretty stupid contract.
I think you're probably right, Jonathan. On the pitch, Wickham beat Lincoln 3-1, as you said. Their left-back, Joe Jacobson, scored sort of a hat-trick. The dubious goals panel have given one as an own goal.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's outrageous, because I've never been to a game where somebody had scored direct from a corner twice, and then to have that robbed of something I can talk about in 20 years' time. Wickham fully deserved a victory. They went top of the table in doing so. First goal was a free kick. I've felt that maybe the wall and goalkeeper could have done a little bit better. The second one, which has gone down as an own goal, looked to be going in to me. And the third one was curled into the sort of the top corner, the opposite corner. Was a great free kick. Even in open play, Jacobson was a real big threat for Wickham. Gareth Ainsworth is doing an unbelievable job there on, you know, limited resources. They have had some American investment over the summer, but still, wouldn't have expected to be top even at this early stage. A very competitive team, quite like Freeman in midfield, and fully deserved to beat Lincoln.
Coventry came back from two goals down to win 3-2 over Blackpool to move up to second. MK Dons beat AFC Wimbledon 2-1. I was there doing a radio show before the game. I left just before kickoff, though, because obviously had to get back for Polytechnic 4's game with Allain Old Boys 3's.
First game of the season.
5-0 victory, hat-trick for Lee Bolton. 43. Still scoring goals. Nigel Adderley's tweet, there was someone at Stadium MK today wearing a half and half scarf. AFC Wimbledon, MK Dons, half and half scarf is quite extraordinary, isn't he? Adderley says staggered, absolutely staggered. Exeter are still top of League Two after a 3-1 win at Carlisle. Cambridge were robbed 1-0 for the third game in a row, losing this time to Forest Green Rovers. And Stevenage have sacked their manager Dino Mamria. Mark Sampson, the former England women's coach, has taken temporary charge, having joined as first team coach in pre-season.
Sunderland's takeover should go through this week.
Righty-ho. Who's taking it over?
Some American investors, including the man who owns Dell, Mr. Dell.
Mr. Dell.
But they are phenomenally rich.
Oh,
I think, in a very technical sense, Sunderland become the richest club in Britain this week.
Oh,
I definitely wouldn't have told Dino he was getting sacked. Have you seen the size of his arms? He's one of the most imposing characters you could ever wish to see on the touchline. That would have been done by WhatsApp or something.
So what would you... You just wouldn't have sat... You'd have got another manager in and then he'd have turned... Just hope he'd keep turning up.
I would have just let him take Stevenage down, I think. Carry on.
Gracia out. Kike Sanchez Flores in at Watford. Including the tail end of last season, Watford have just won just 5 of their last 16 league games. They're bottom of the Premier League, 1 point after defeats to Brighton, Everton and West Ham, and a draw against Newcastle. Flores was in charge of Watford for the 2015-16 season, steering them to 13th and getting to the FA Cup semi-finals. Not surprised, because Watford just sacked managers, right?
Yeah. It was, in a sense, it was slightly surprising that he even began this season, but...
Get him to the Cup final, I mean...
Yeah, but people who get to the cup final get sacked. Like, whether they win or lose in the cup final, getting to the cup final is really bad for your career.
I just think that Watford feel like it's the, you know, freshening up the manager is the, you know, the best way forward for them, and it's worked. I mean, Jokanović was unlucky. You could have said that Kike Sanchez Flores was unlucky to lose his job. And
yeah.
How fresh is it if it's Kike Sanchez Flores?
Oh, but he's nice, isn't he? He's a good manager. He's sort of charismatic. I think it's good to have him back.
But surely it wasn't working at some point. I mean.
Well,
why wasn't it working? And why would
up as well? Yeah, it might even be your line, but I love that line about Kike Sanchez Flores, that he's a man Phil Brown thinks he is.
I'd like to take the credit, but but I can't.
Yeah. Well.
That's the Watford news. Gary Monk's been appointed manager of Sheffield Wednesday, finally replacing Steve Bruce. Why are you laughing,
Mark? Well, I said to somebody when he was sacked by Birmingham and all the stories that came out afterwards that, you know, there's no way Gary Monk's getting a job, you know, for a long time. And I'm nearly right. It was about 2 months before somebody gave him another opportunity. I am surprised, though.
Marca reported over the weekend some members of Barcelona's squad were so desperate to have Neymar back at the Nou Camp, they offered to help fund the move themselves. So amazing altruism. You know, footballers get a bad name for earning all that money and they could go buy players with it. How would that work? I mean, you know, if he wasn't playing well, would they get the chance to sub him off?
Or? I mean, the worry about that is, I mean, I'm not saying this is true of Neymar, but, you know... what's he called? The Brazilian who never played. Rob Smythe wrote the book about Kaiser.
Okay.
And he basically kept getting jobs because he procured prostitutes for players. So clubs would keep on signing him. He'd get mysterious injuries and never play. But players kept on saying, oh, we've got to have him. He's brilliant. Because he was sorting them out.
Oh.
I'm not saying Neymar's doing that.
No.
But I think you create a very complex series of incentives if you start letting players spy other players.
Well, the rumour at Real Madrid was that Contrao, the left-back, sort of only kept getting new contracts because he was friends with Cristiano Ronaldo, and it was sort of a way of, you know, just keeping him sweet. Was he used to say, yeah, but I want Contrao to have a new contract as well, and he stayed probably longer than many felt that he should have.
Another consequence of that move falling through is that later this month, Neymar will be facing Barcelona in court over a loyalty payment which remains unpaid. Barcelona paid him €14 million out of a total of a €40 million bonus, which they agreed when he signed a new contract in 2016. Barcelona have responded with a counterclaim that Neymar owes them €75 million for the unfulfillment of his contract. If he'd signed for them this summer, both claims would have been dropped. Nicholas Bentner played his first game for FC Copenhagen behind closed doors because the club thought the training ground would have, quote, blown up if they'd allowed supporters to watch the friendly against Bromby.
Did you see the video of him training where he missed single thing?
That was beautiful, wasn't it?
Fantastic.
Just sort of sticking left foot shots 5 yards over the bar. The club sold out of replica shirts thanks to what they're calling Bentner-mania following his arrival, with manager Stolu Solbakken saying, I don't think the marketing department has ever experienced anything like that. Costa Rica's coach, Gustavo Matosas, has resigned after just 8 games in charge, saying, quote, I didn't know being a national team manager was so boring. I won't manage a national team again. I can't only have the players every 2 months. It's not for me.
Costa Rica's first manager after the Second World War was from Sunderland.
Really?
Randolph Galloway.
Have you been to Costa Rica?
No, never.
I just imagine, has he not looked at the FIFA dates? Hold on, yeah, well, I've got these months.
Couldn't he just do something else? I mean, you know.
Learn a hobby?
Yeah.
Like,
there's plenty of other things you can do to keep yourself interested while your players are away. Jonathan, you wrote a piece about Sheffield United's overlapping centre-backs in the paper yesterday in The Observer. Did you just cut and paste it from one of your books?
No, I'd never written about it before.
Oh, all right. Okay.
I mean, what do you want me to say?
Well, you just appraise of it if you want.
The point I was making in the piece was that there's various changes in the game which sort of all came together in around about 2008, and you can see a marked change in how many goals per game there are in the Champions League pre-2008 and post-2008. There's a lot more since 2008. So what has 2008 was also, of course, the year when Guardiola became a manager. So the environment that's allowed Guardiola to play his football is also the environment that's allowed Sheffield United to come up with a solution to the problem they had when they were in League One. When teams would sit very deep against them, they had to try and find space or find new ways of breaking the opposition defensive lines. And they realised that their two centre-backs weren't... the two flanking centre-backs in their back three were just sitting on the halfway line doing nothing. So you might as well go forward. There were some teething problems. They lost 4-1 at Walsall, but they've resolved that by using the three centre midfielders to sort of provide cover.
And it's all because of Pep.
It's not all because of Pep. And I made them change the headline when they came up with a headline that suggests it was all because of Pep.
Oh, really?
The same environment that's allowed Pep to be Pep has allowed Chris Wilder and Alan Neil to be Chris Wilder and Alan Neil. And it's good for Alan Neil because previously he was only famous for getting knocked off his bike by a squirrel.
He is. And do you know what happened to me on Saturday?
Did you get knocked off your bike by a squirrel?
No, but... So
a badger.
I was going to Stadium MK.
A
right?
Mouse.
No.
A shrew.
No. I didn't get knocked off my bike. So I had to leave early.
You knocked it off his bike?
I knocked a squirrel off his bike, yeah. I had to leave early and I left the house, and this happens to me quite a lot. Because I don't drive very often, I'd forgotten where I'd parked the car. So I'm sort of walking around the streets near where I live, not being able to find my car. So I'm just pressing the key and hoping something flashes, right? And then I had to get one of those e-bikes, right? You can get these electric bikes on an app. And I scanned the bike and so I could pedal round the streets more quickly. And I was in this frantic hurry and a squirrel ran out and I ran over a squirrel on my bicycle. I know, it's quite traumatic.
That's your Alan Neil.
I had my Alan Neil moment. But I only went over it with the front wheel, and the back wheel is quite weight-bearing. And then he ran off. But I don't know if the squirrel's okay or he's just... gone to a quiet place. But it was it was a really sort of unpleasant sort of he sort of panicked, he ran out and he did that face, and I was like, I couldn't move because the e-bikes they're quite quick, these things. And then
do you think there was in squirrel language as a phrase for rabbit in the headlights?
I mean, it's possible. Squirrel in the dynamo, is that
what?
Well,
I'm just wondering what their equivalent phrase is. Do the squirrels mock the rabbits for kind of...
Do you know what? And then yesterday, another squirrel ran out at me. And I was on my bike.
Well, I mean, you have declared war on them now.
Well,
you've got to expect these guerrilla attacks.
I would like to apologise to all squirrels. And I empathise with Alan Neil. Previously, I just thought it was funny how you could get knocked off your bike by a squirrel. I mean, I kept my balance. That's okay, isn't it? Anyway. Hey, Susie, thanks for coming.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Cheers.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.